It is a privilege and great joy to have this opportunity to be with you today, to be invited to just have this moment where we pause on this process that you're on for searching for your new settled minister. What a joy it was on Friday evening to spend time with your search committee who are doing the good and labored work for this congregation. And what a joy it was yesterday to be with a little bit over 40 of you who showed up for this three-hour workshop yesterday. I'm so grateful to be with you today. That this Beyond Categorical Thinking workshop is a Unitarian Universalist Association program that is designed to help congregations understand the impact of categorical thinking on your search process specifically and congregational life in general. So, what is categorical thinking? Most of us have some thoughts that come to mind when we think about that. Thinking in categories comes naturally to us. We look someone over and in the speed of light decide how tall they are, what race, ethnicity we think they are. Can they walk? Who are they with? What gender are they? But it's not just this noticing that takes us down this trail of trying to figure people out. It's our internalized stories that we learn, and our lives are full of these stories. These stories are the foundations of our beliefs about ourselves and others. And we live out these narratives. Ethicist Charles Curran calls these the normative perspectives from which all others are seen. It's like we live on this small piece of land, on this postage stamp size of knowledge, and from that we draw conclusions and assumptions and interpretations. We build these out of our position in society. And we build these out of the stories that we hear from our families. We inherit these stories from our ancestors. And they inform and affect how we choose to go about our lives. Some of these stories are so deeply embedded in the systemic issues of racism and injustice that I and perhaps you live out some of these or encounter these experiences on a daily basis. Our Unitarian Universalist faith calls us to engage in dismantling these complex systems and call us to develop and create beloved communities in their place. It calls us to find our role in that process. And our sanctuaries here create opportunities for us to reflect on how all the years of accumulated life culminates in what we believe and how we behave. I grew up in Waterville, Maine, where I worshiped at St. Mark's Episcopal Church, but attended Mount Mercy Academy, the local Catholic school. If that wasn't confusing enough, in the evenings at my request, my mother would read me Bible stories, but she would preempt them with phrases like, "Remember, Donna, these are stories to learn by." And you know, Jesus wasn't really born in the winter. With an Episcopal and Catholic upbringing tinged with this humanist interpretation of the Bible, it makes perfect sense now to me that I'm Unitarian Universalist. I learned a lot growing up from my home, from family and friends, from church and school, from my school, Mount Mercy. I learned how to swear in French on the playground. I learned making friends wasn't about who had the best outfit, since we all wore the same one. And I learned that I could get more dessert on Lima Bean Day. There was a lot of pressure in the cafeteria to eat everything you were given on your plate. So I had this program going where I would trade with a couple of classmates. I'll eat your lima beans if you give me your dessert. Now, there were a couple of winners on lima bean days, and it always worked out well for me because I liked lima beans and dessert. At Mount Marcy, I also learned that Episcopal people could not take Catholic communion. And I learned that after my third year of taking Catholic communion. And since we're nearing on National Coming Out Day, someone outed me as Episcopal. I might have been the only youth in my class who had a prayer stand in their bedroom, prayer beads on that stand, and pictures of saints and Jesus who did not get to take Catholic communion. It was very disappointing at the time. I've learned some helpful and not so helpful categorical thinking. Growing up, I learned pretty early on that large, furry black cats with white stripes were good to stay away from. They smelled less than desirable. I learned that if things were pretty far down, it meant that they really were far down, which I learned from leaping out of trees from great heights more than once. So those of you who might have bumped up into the need to learn a lesson more than once might relate to that story. It was not helpful to learn, however, that if you learned differently than schools taught, that you weren't smart. And I learned this last one that led me to being perceived in grade school on through high school as someone who was not trying hard enough. I heard over and over that if I tried harder, I would be able to do it. I would be able to spell. I would be able to do the math. I would succeed. Well, I did try, as many can relate to, because every child wants to succeed. I tried and I tried, and yet I continued to learn lessons through high school. I learned from my guidance counselor that I was not smart enough to apply to college. And I learned that when he told me, "Donna, I don't think you should bother to apply." And I probably wouldn't have applied had I not already learned to be good and stubborn from my mother. She might have found it annoying at the time, but it's been a handy skill. So it was with some trepidation and determination that I set out to college to prove my guidance counselor wrong. It turned out to be a driving motivator for my first year in school, which was handy, but I can think of better motivators now. I've come to understand that his categorical thinking included perceptions of students with less than stellar grades as not smart enough to make it in college. What I didn't realize about myself then was that I probably had an undiagnosed learning disability. You might be thinking, something like that, Donna, could happen way back when you were in school, but maybe not anymore. But it could. A few years ago, I did one of these beyond categorical thinking gigs with a congregation that was just a little smaller than yours. I was the contact person, which meant that we emailed back and forth, as Livia and Nancy can attest to, many emails trying to get the details of the event down. But I still spell the same way I always have. I don't discriminate. I misspell short and long words. Because of a commitment that evening with the search committee, I was not able to make it to the meeting, and my colleague met with them instead. Later, my colleague told me that the search committee asked if I was educated. Now, I believe they were not so much curious what my education was, but wanted to know if I was smart enough to do the job. Now you might be thinking, okay, Donna, where was that congregation? Because that would not happen in any other UU congregation. And I invite you to consider what it was like when I told this story in another congregation. And someone came up to me afterwards who happened to be a school counselor and said to me, "You might have misunderstood your guidance counselor. Or perhaps there was another reason they told you that." Now, sometimes things can feel a little uncomfortable when we hear them. And I think for this particular person, it was. We are not immune to that reaction, though. Her discomfort and wanting to step away from my story can happen to any of us when we get a little uncomfortable. Now, I really don't have anything against school counselors. And I think that I ended up with the minority who really were not very good at launching youth into their future. I'm sure you can take a moment and remember being on the receiving end of some experience or comment that allowed you to realize that there are times in life when you are stung by feeling different, made fun of, or left behind. There are and probably will continue to be times when someone makes a joke or calls us names or perhaps has some other, a little more subtle, out the side microaggression that happens. Laughs at us, thinks we're not equipped for some reason to engage in the community or this community. Perhaps we're so shocked when it happens, we don't quite have the courage to speak up. When we see it happening, we may be left without words. Each of us certainly has a responsibility with our faith to lean into those moments, to find a way with nonviolent communication that you have been working on in this congregation, to notice, give voice, and call someone back to your covenant when they need a little help, when they need a moment to understand that this was not okay. Now, I continue to work on my life's messages, and I suspect that I will until my last breath. I've learned and had to face what it means to be a woman as I made friends with and began to work with folks who were genderqueer and transgender. As this experience bumped up into my learning, my narrow learning, I remember feeling like my niece did when she was 5 and we were floating around in the pool one day, and she looks at me in all earnest seriousness that 5-year-olds can sometimes do, right? And I know I'm being called to something important. And she looks at me and says, "Do you color your hair white?" She had this look about her, and I said, "No, it grows this way." And she was silent for what seemed like forever until she looked at me and said, "That's weird." She did not have the information that would inform her about what aging might be like, that it could include a color change. It could include loss of hair. It could include lots of things. And that's what happened when I started to make friends with people who were not in those 2 limited boxes that were sold as a bill of goods, this binary gender of man and woman. And what I finally learned was, I don't get to define that for anyone else. The only thing I can define is my own sense of identity and naming that for myself. And the other opportunity that I'm welcomed into is to listen with openness and curiosity about someone else's experience. Now, deconstructing these barriers, sometimes not so comfortable. And I encountered this a few years ago when I attended a Changing Maine for Racial Justice workshop. I was living in Maine at the time. And it was an opportunity, as we had yesterday, to start to look at some of the ways that we think, and I did that. There was this one exercise in the morning, and I had stepped out to make a phone call or get a drink or something like that. And I stepped back in, and the 60 people in the room were just starting the activity, and I stood to the side. And in my mind, I thought, I don't want to interrupt. It seemed the polite thing to do in my mind. But as the facilitator debriefed after the exercise, she pointed out, it's a privilege not to participate. It's a privilege to take that choice not to engage. It's ongoing work. It's ongoing work. And sometimes I fall into what Alan Johnson calls the luxury of obliviousness, the sense of entitlement that entrenches me so deeply into my privilege that I haven't even noticed that I'm there. Perhaps this happens to you once in a while. Because this work of dismantling our systems of oppression and rebuilding justice-based systems and our role in it is ongoing work, the work of our Unitarian Universalist living faith. Now, we use like to learn. We like time to read. We like time to talk with each other. We like book groups. We like discussion groups. And some of us have the privilege of taking that time as we live without question in a binary identity, in a majority role in this society that gives you a privilege to access things that other people don't have access to. Time is a place for the privileged. And I say to you that those who are living in the tide of oppression have no more time for us to spend in quiet group reflection on our own. They're expecting us to show up, expecting us to practice our faith beyond our sanctuaries. We have a role in our communities that is vital. Let us connect with that breath of fire that ignites our hearts and spirits and invites us to keep showing up.